Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for August 28, 2003. And this is Doug Henman. We're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And it's been a couple of weeks, first blackout and then fundraising. And I just missed getting caught in the subway on the way down here a couple of weeks ago, so I was glad I was just a tiny bit behind schedule. Otherwise, I would have been one of those poor souls stuck in the subway for 3 hours. We've got two segments scheduled for tonight. First, we'll speak with Michael Albert, one of the founding editors of Z Magazine and one of the founders of South End Press. But we're speaking to him in his capacity as the author of the recently published book, Paracon, Life After Capitalism. Paracon is short for participatory economics. And we're going to talk to him about what this world might look like in a life after capitalism. And then at about 5:30 or a bit after, we'll speak with Christian Parenti, who is a journalist and spent a couple of weeks in Iraq and came back just last week. And he was tagging around with some U.S. soldiers and talking to people on the streets of Baghdad. So we'll have a report for him, what he saw on his strange summer vacation in Baghdad. And as we often do, I'm going to begin, before we bring up Michael Albert, I want to begin with a couple of observations about the economic news of the last couple of days. First of all, a couple of words. This is most of what I have to say will focus on the U.S. economy because that's where we live and that's what I follow most closely, and also it's generally what drives the rest of the world's economy. In short, it was announced that the Brazilian GDP fell in the most recent quarter, deepening Brazil's recession and, of course, deepening the political troubles that the Lula government faces there. The European economy has continued to stumble, showing some signs of recovery, only to be followed by signs of stumbling again. So basically, they're not really getting off the mat. One of the few bright spots, if you can call it that, in the world economy right now is Japan, of all places, which has been stuck in a stagnation for over a decade, but is showing some signs of recovery. So we will see if that's amounts to anything, or it's been another one of those false dawns that Japan has seen since its economy fell apart in the early 1990s. But, of course, the big story in the U.S. is the U.S. economy recovering. The recession officially ended in November of 2001, but we've lost several hundred thousand jobs since the economy allegedly bottomed, and a lot of other economic indicators have been going nowhere, but lately they've been surprising on the upside. In fact, an account kept by Merrill Lynch showed 10 of the 13 most recent releases of economic data in the U.S. I think their count was of a day or two ago, so this would have to be updated, but it gives you an idea of what's been going on. 10 of the 13 have been above what people were expecting, so most of the surprises have been pleasant ones, and it was reported this morning that estimates of GDP growth in the second quarter of this year. The first estimates were released about a month ago, and they've updated those estimates. And almost all of the components of that were revised upwards. Consumption was much stronger than expected. Business investment is showing some signs of life, best performance in 3 years, and that's what really it's going to take to get the economy in this country moving again. But the real star of the GDP report was military spending, up almost 45% at an annual rate, the fastest rate since the Korean War. So the broad economy does seem to be showing some signs of recovery, but the strongest thing right now is the Pentagon. The weekly count of claims for first-time claims for unemployment insurance, that's people lose their jobs and go visit the unemployment office, that weekly number was up slightly this week from the previous week. And the four-week average of that, designed to smooth out some of the week-to-week volatility in the series, has been flat now for three consecutive weeks. So there had been some sign of improvement as July turned into August, but now it seems to have stalled a bit, at least that improvement. And the count of people continuing to draw unemployment claims has been flat for about 5 weeks in a row. So slight signs of improvement, but not much in the job market. Also, the weekly count of mortgage applications by the Mortgage Bankers Association shows those falling again as interest rates have risen. Demand for mortgages has been falling, and demand for housing has been one of the things that kept the U.S. economy afloat over the last couple of years. And particularly what's really kept the U.S. economy afloat is so-called cash-out refinancings. That is when people go in to get a new mortgage because of a decline in interest rates and try to take advantage of those lower interest rates by refinancing their old loans. They've generally been taking cash out on the deal. The value of their houses has appreciated, at least on paper, and so they've been taking that out in the form of cash. That means their debts are higher, and they've been spending that additional cash at a very strong rate, contributed a lot to U.S. economic strength, such as it was over the last couple of years. And that prop to economic activity has been growing steadily weaker. The refinancing index is off almost 80% from its high in May. So we do need a recovery in the job market if we're going to keep the consumer side of the economy going. And speaking of that job market, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York has just released an interesting study of what's been happening with the job market in the current economic cycle. In most recessions, people lose their jobs in relatively large numbers, there are two components to that. When the business cycle weakens, when demand slows, when the economy slows in general, people get laid off. But these are typically, in most post-World War II recessions, have been temporary layoffs. And when the economy picks up again, a lot of the workers are eventually recalled. That's not happened this time. It seems that most of the job losses have been permanent. We first saw this in the recession of about 10, 12 years ago, in the early 90s, when we saw some permanent job losses, rather more permanent job losses than temporary ones. But this time around, we've seen even more of that. Almost 80%, 4 out of 5 of the jobs lost in this recession and the subsequent jobless recovery have been permanent losses. And so we're not seeing much in the way of recalls to employment. So it's going to take new hiring in new positions. And it seems that there have been some structural changes rather than the purely business cycle ones going on. A lot of industries overinvested, overexpanded, and they've been severely laying off people, things like electronics and telecommunications. Also, the securities and brokerage industry, similar, got wildly expansive in the 90s expansion and has now been shedding workers like crazy. So it seems that that it's not been a normal business cycle, that some kind of long-term structural shifts are underway, and that employers are particularly unwilling to hire new employees. And if you want to read the report, it should be on the Federal Reserve Bank of New York's website right now. I don't have the URL, but just go search for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and it should be there. And now we're joined on the line by Michael Albert, who has been involved with South End Press and Z Magazine from the beginnings of both of those enterprises, but also author of many books and articles, and in particular on the subject of participatory economics, Paracon. And Verso has just recently published Paracon, Life After Capitalism. And Paracon, as I said earlier, participatory economics. Welcome to WBAI, Michael.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
So let me start. You certainly don't have to convince me of this, but I guess journalistic integrity requires me to ask you this. What's wrong with capitalism? Why does it need to be replaced?
Well, I guess when a report on the economy says that there's some hope, and the essence of the hope is that military spending is increasing, we live in a not very good economy. But that's just, capitalism is an economy in which some people accrue gigantic masses of wealth, some owning hundreds of millions, even billions of dollars, Bill Gates being worth more than, perhaps the population of Norway. Other people sleep under bridges and, are homeless, 7 million people homeless, 7 million empty hotel rooms at any given moment. It's an economy which has gigantic disparities of wealth and power. But that isn't all. It's an economy which is organized around the logic of a rat race, in which buyers and sellers try to fleece one another, and the largest rat succeeds. This is an economy that warps personal dispositions to be humane and to have empathy with one another and social values, and creates antisociality instead. It's an economy which divides people into classes that contest with each other, in part bad because of the indignity and the subordination involved, in part bad because of the loss to creativity and productivity. I mean, there are so many things wrong with capitalism, even before you talk about wars and, you know, the most gross and large-scale violations of human life that it engenders. So that makes me an anti-capitalist, or these array of things and many more that could be described make me an anti-capitalist and make me feel like it makes sense not just to be an anti-capitalist, but to be pro-something, to be able to offer an alternative which I think, you know, embodies the values and the desires that I hold dear.
And I have to endorse that sentiment. I've been very bad in that regard myself. It's much easier to be a critic than it is to be constructive. And I took some calls on this show sometime last year, and somebody asked me to do, one of the callers asked for a lot more positive alternatives, so this is part of an attempt to comply with that request. But before we get to the positive, your positive program, just one more of these annoying gnat-like questions. I'm sure there are many people who might agree with your critique of capitalism. It's brutal and it's ugly and it's degrading and destructive and polarizing and unstable and many other unpleasant adjectives that I could think of if I had more time. But, you know, it's the best we can do. There is no alternative. We need these disparities of wealth as an incentive. Otherwise, we'd just all get fat and lazy.
Look, if it's true, that is to say, if somebody could make a coherent, compelling case that it was true, it would be a powerful argument. So suppose somebody back before we had capitalism, when we had feudalism, could make the case that feudalism was the only viable economy, that there was no alternative, that there was no future, that it made no sense to move in any kind of new direction. Well, if it's true, it's compelling. If it's false, it's not compelling. Suppose somebody in the South during slavery said, look, there's no other way to deal with cotton. There's no other way to get this work done. There's no other way to amass this kind of energy. It's just a necessary evil. It's like aging. We have to put up with it. We have to recognize that it's a part of life and endure it. I think that sentiment is hugely widespread. So that in the United States, I would say that, in fact, deep down, in a discussion in which it isn't polarized and you know, one's identity isn't at stake, most people are anti-capitalist. Most people in the United States actually believe that everything is broken. They believe, if you look at popular culture, you can see it all over the place in novels and mysteries and adventures and so on. You know, pharmaceutical companies trying to kill the population as the plot line in a manner that exceeds what the left claims. These are typical, and nobody finds them peculiar. Nobody finds them extreme because everybody sort of accepts it as the reality. But as you say, they feel like, well, the alternative is barbaric. The alternative is that we all starve. So that's why a vision is desirable, it's necessary. When Margaret Thatcher says there is no alternative, she's basically voicing a sentiment which is the biggest obstacle, in my view, or certainly one of the largest obstacles to activism. If you think that there is no alternative, then fighting against injustice, fighting against poverty, even though you like poverty, I mean, even though you dislike poverty, even though you dislike injustice, even though you're horrified by these things, is irrational. In the same way, it would be irrational to fight against aging. I mean, after all, aging kills us all. So why not come join me in a movement against aging? Well, because it's idiotic. There's no such thing as a movement against aging, and aging is a part of life. If capitalism is a part of life, then being anti-capitalist, being a dissident, being an activist, being a revolutionary is just irrational. So we have to offer an alternative. We have to explain why it is that something else is possible, that something else could work, that something else could deliver the goods, accomplish production, accomplish consumption, but propel values that we held dear and create a better world in order for people to feel that it's worthwhile to fight against this thing.
Yeah, I don't know. you shouldn't diss the anti-aging movement. I think that's a good bit of programming in the, the afternoon in this station.
So I wish it could win.
That's a topic. That's a topic. Maybe a little sensitive. I'm speaking with Michael Albert, author of the book Paracon: Life After Capitalism, just published by Verso. So let's talk about your alternative system then. Could you? You've got some principles on which it's based and from which you develop the system. What are those principles?
Well, it's one way to think about this. I mean, you know, it's sort of a big task. How do you think about an alternative way of organizing an economy? For me, what makes sense is to sort of ask myself, well, what do I want to achieve? What do I want to accomplish? What should the economic institutions further? What values do I hold dear? And the things that I come up with are solidarity. An economy is better if it causes us to be mutually supportive, mutually empathetic, if it makes us be social beings instead of causing us to try and fleece one another, to try and outdo one another, to advance at another's debit. So that's the first value, solidarity. Another value that seems to me to make sense is diversity. We want an economy which diversifies options. Rather than homogenizing choices, it diversifies, of course, good options, not mindlessly. But it doesn't diminish the breadth and scope of what we can do with our lives. Instead, it enriches it. And a third thing that an economy impacts, of course, is how we impact decisions. How much say do we have? And here the value that makes sense to me, I call self-management. I mean, other people might use another name for it, but that's the label I use. And what I mean by it is, it seems to me that we should have a say in decisions in proportion to how much they affect us. That's really the value, if you want, the aspiration that we have. We understand it in our own lives. If a group of us are sort of negotiating a movie to go to or, you know, whatever it might happen to be, we pay attention to how much the choice is going to affect somebody in assessing how much say they should have over the choice. So in a workplace, you know, if you're deciding whether or not you should have a picture of the person you live with, your spouse or your child or something, in your little work booth, and if nobody else is going to see it, it doesn't affect anybody else, it's a dictatorial decision. You just make it. Nobody thinks that everybody should have a vote in that. Nobody thinks that the people who aren't going to see it should have a say over it. We sort of understand that it makes sense that that's a private decision, that decision that affects only you. Suppose you want to bring a boombox in, and you want to play music in your little workspace. Well, that affects other people, and we all understand intuitively, immediately, that it isn't a private decision. That now the people impacted should have a say in it, but not the people who aren't impacted. So that's self-management. And the last realm of value that I think about is distribution. How much should we get? What should be the norm? I guess we could say, by which it's determined how much of the social product we each get. What's our income? What share do we get? Should we be remunerated for property that we own? So Bill Gates is, you know, worth billions. Should we be remunerated more by virtue of having better tools than somebody else? I get more because I'm lucky enough to have better tools. Should I get more because I'm stronger? Because I can take more. That's the way it is in our society, bargaining power. I think that the norm that makes sense is that people should be remunerated for their effort and sacrifice, so that if I put out more effort and I endure more sacrifice in the work that I do, I get more to elicit it from me and because it's warranted morally. And if I put out less, I get less. Some of these are uncontroversial. Some of them are quite controversial. But if somebody had these as their, you know, guiding values, if you will, and then thought about production, consumption, and allocation, I think they might well come up with what I call participatory economics, at least it's what I came up with, as a set of institutions that can accomplish economic functions but fulfill these values.
Let's talk about a couple. Time is short, so let's just focus on a couple of specifics of this scheme.
Sure.
First of all, your idea of balanced job complexes. Mm-hmm. Could you define that and just lay out what it might look like?
Well, one of the things that violates those values is if people have systematically different control over their economic lives, systematically different power. And one of the roots of systematically different power is if, you know, Charlie owns the workplace and Sue works in it, and Charlie gets to decide everything because he owns it. So that's one problem. But there's another problem, and that is if Charlie works all day in the workplace, and by virtue of what he does, he has a tremendous amount of knowledge and overarching understanding of the workplace, social skills, and so on. If his work empowers him, and I forget what her name was already, but the other person, Julie or Sarah or whatever it may be, the other person, or Sam, works all day at deadening work, at debilitating work that's disempowering, then you can predict with great confidence that the empowered actor in the workplace is going to have more influence over the outcomes in the workplace. And what the idea of a balanced job complex is to eliminate the corporate division of labor, a division of labor which creates a hierarchy in which about 20% of the workforce monopolizes empowering work and is a class above the other roughly 80% who does rote and obedient work. And in a balanced job complex, instead of some people having all the empowering tasks, we all have a share of the empowering tasks. So we all have a job, which is a little more complex than now. Instead of being so homogenous, it has a mix of responsibilities and tasks that suits us. It's different for different people. But it's a fair mix, so that my mix and somebody else's mix and yours and somebody else's and so on have comparable empowerment effects. It isn't the case that some of us, 20%, have all the empowering things to do and the other 80% have all the rote and obedient things to do. Rather, it's distributed in a way that each of us has a roughly comparably empowering job, which eliminates this class distinction.
And the other aspect, or principal aspect, is this idea of participatory planning.
Yeah.
That is, instead of Soviet-style central planning, or whether capitalist or even market socialist versions of competitive markets with floating prices, you've got a different idea of how to organize production and allocation of goods.
This is hard to explain quickly. And I don't even think I'll try and do that so per se. What I would say is the idea is that roughly, oversimplified, producers and consumers both have desires, and they bring these desires to a planning process, if you will, to a negotiation of what the economic results should be. And the producers are basically expressing what it is that they think is desirable to produce, what makes sense for them to produce in the workplace. The consumers are proposing what they wish to consume, and there needs to be some mediation of these desires leading to a decision. So in central planning, the mediation ultimately is that the central planners simply decide. They cull the information by a variety of means, basically pulling it from the populace, and then they decide. They make a decision from the top. In markets, what happens is that each actor seeks to pursue their own well-being irrespective of the effects on everybody else. It's a competitive dynamic. And it's a long discussion, but in markets it means that those who aren't immediately affected, who aren't the immediate buyer and seller, are pretty much excluded from the dynamic at hand. In participatory economics, what happens is that workers and consumers' councils engage in a social procedure, if you will, a negotiation across the society in which a plan evolves step by step. And in this procedure, and nobody should accept this based on hearing it from me, you know, in this kind of a presentation, but what I would argue is that in this procedure, once one looks at the whole thing, each actor is self-managing. The various actors, groups, like, for instance, the people who live in a neighborhood or who work in a workplace, and individuals, a specific person in the neighborhood or a specific person in the workplace, impact decisions roughly, in fact pretty closely, in proportion to the degree that they're affected by them. So you have self-management, and more, you have that the decisions are undertaken in light of true social costs and benefits. So instead of the decision being just in light of the impact on the immediate buyer and seller, the decisions take into account the broad social implications for everyone who's affected, including how it affects the people who do the work, the people who live in the area where the outputs of the work flow into the environment, the people who consume the product, and so on and so forth. Now, that's a big claim. It's on the face of it, it's pretty implausible that one could have an allocation system which accomplishes allocation and yet gives people self-management. But that's what I claim is true for participatory planning. And what I guess I would say to the audience is you should hope I'm right. people should hope, just like people under slavery, should hope that the abolitionist is right, that we can get rid of slavery and replace it with something that accomplishes economic functions but doesn't have those properties. People likewise should hope that we can get rid of markets, abusive markets, replace them with a system that delivers self-management, that properly evaluates inputs and outputs, makes decisions about them in terms of human well-being and development, and gets the job done. And that's the claim for participatory planning.
And I should say that the book, Paracon, Life After Capitalism, published by Verso, 300 pages, you lay this out in detail. So if people are wondering what this all these principles really mean in some sense of practice, then they can pick up the book and find out. Or visit paracon.org on the web, where there's much, much material also on this particular topic. But let me, I should say, I'll speak with Michael Albert, who is the author of Paracon, Life After Capitalism, published by Verso. And since time is running short, let me get to a couple of questions and critiques that have been raised about Paracon.
Sure.
First of all, there's the one, I'm sure you've heard this, economist Nancy Fulbray from UMass described it to me as a vision of life as one long student council meeting. It's just too many meetings, and there's problems of boredom, but also a tyranny of the sociable. That is, people who are good at meetings will tend to dominate them, and the wallflowers will be dominated. What do you think of that critique?
Well, suppose for a minute it was true. Let's take it at face value. I'm going to reject it in a minute. But suppose it was true that Paracon was a system in which there was a tremendous premium on liking meetings, and so the people who liked meetings more would have an advantage over the people who liked meetings less. If that was true, it would seem to me that it would be a far less egregious failing than to be a economy in which there's a bias toward people who own the whole economy and there's a set of people who do, or to be an economy in which there's a bias toward people who monopolize empowering work, and that was what the economies called socialist had, because this kind of bias that Nancy is talking about is rather easy to overcome, I think, just with a little extra effort, a little extra involvement that might be a bit discomforting to somebody, but certainly wouldn't be precluded. But in fact, it's not really true. It comes from a view of Paracon that arises from quick presentations, or even longer than this, long enough to discuss the kinds of engagements that are involved, and it feels like meetings. But if you actually compare Paracon, as the books do, to current society, and you ask how much time goes to certain kinds of pursuits, you see that you gain as much as you lose. So you gain back all the time that went into hostile interactions, that went into certain kinds of conflicts that were gone, that went into cleaning up disastrous results that no longer are produced in the first place. So you gain a whole lot that is made up. Now, if you want to say democracy takes a little bit longer than dictatorship, you could say that for the political sphere too. It's probably much more efficient in terms of the actual total time put into decisions to have 1 or 10 or 15 people at the top make them all, irrespective of what anybody else thinks. But that's not our sole value. So once again, if it took longer, if we lost some time as a result of the need to have a negotiated process, to have real self-management, what we gain in getting rid of classes and getting rid of gross inequalities and getting rid of the indignities and getting rid of class division and so on would more than outweigh it. So I think people, you know, have to look for themselves to judge whether or not they think it would take a little longer or a little less long. I think quite a bit less long. To conduct economic life in a Paracon. But I think, you know, that as sole value is a mistake. There are other values as well.
And also a different kind of critique, the how to get there from here question. One of the reasons that Marx, for example, was skeptical of utopian blueprints was that it they really sort of didn't pay enough attention to the political mechanisms and struggles necessary to get there. So what's your idea of how we get to this utopian state?
I don't actually understand that in some sense. So it seems to me that if you want to get someplace good, okay, so we all want to get someplace good. You want to get someplace good, and you want to ask about how you do it. It helps to know where that someplace good is, because what you need to do in your strategy is to adopt tactics and methods and organizational structures that will, I'm sorry about that, that's a loud noise outside, that will melt into what you seek rather than strategies and structures and organizational procedures that generate something that you didn't like. So, for instance, I think that in various revolutionary upsurges in history, there have been many, many people who desired to have an end to wage slavery, who desired to have a desirable classless society result, and the results were nothing like that. Why? Well, in part because some of the people weren't seeking that, and in part because the strategic means weren't leading to that. They were anti-capitalist, but they weren't pro what was sought. So I actually think you need vision in order to have a good strategy. What does it tell you? Well, it tells you some things like this. It might say, for instance, if we want balanced job complexes in a new economy, maybe we should aspire toward, step by step, balanced job complexes in our organizations and our, you know, our vehicles of struggle and our projects in the current economy. Maybe part of the reason why our movements have trouble attracting and retaining working class participation is because our movements feel, in class terms, a lot like the society outside. That's one kind of, among many, observation that arises quickly when you have a pericon-ish perspective. It's very much like the kind of observation that arrived 30 years ago when, say, the black community or the women's community said to the left, wait a minute, if the left looks like patriarchy, if the left looks like Jim Crow racism in society, we don't want to be part of it. It's too alienating. It's too destructive. We don't believe it will lead any place good. I think working people feel that sometimes intuitively, sometimes very, very explicitly about our movements, because our movements don't embody an understanding of what the roots of class difference are and don't reflect a real commitment to overcoming that. So that's one thing. I think that a pericon-ish strategy is not going to be a Leninist strategy because it's not going to see any relationship, any positive relationship between Leninist organization and self-management. It's going to advocate a different kind of organizational form and structure and decision-making in our movements because it advocates self-management as part of the vision, as what we're trying to attain. It'll try and build workers' and consumers' councils. So it won't be satisfied just with unions, although it'll support them. It'll try and build workers' and consumers'. In other words, there are many implications that are immediate and strategic that arise from having vision and that don't necessarily arise if we don't have vision.
All right, we're just about out of time, but one final question. Would people still be allowed to buy Britney Spears albums?
Well, buying is a different phenomenon in pericon. I know you mean it. Will performers exist who produce music? Yes. Will Britney Spears be one of those, or Britney Spears-like character be one of those people? Yes, if there's interest. In a pericon, you're rewarded for socially valuable labor. That means that your labor, there won't be albums produced by me because they would be terrible and nobody would want them. And I can't become the shortstop of the Yankees because I can't play baseball. Or, you know, I can't become a pilot of an airplane because my eyes aren't any good. So there's only qualitatively worthy products, in terms of people's desire for them and need for them. But I can't guess whether or not, you know, the population will value or not value singing by Britney Spears. Bruce will still be around.
Okay. Thanks for joining us, Michael Albert.
Okay.
Michael Albert is the author of Paracon, Life After Capitalism, just published by Verso. And we'll be back with Christian Parenti. I should say this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and on the web at WBAI.org. And we'll be back to speak with Christian Parenti after this word from Roxy Music. Excerpt from Lady Tron from the Roxy Music, 1972, their eponymous album. Now we're joined in the studio by Christian Parenti, who is a journalist, author of Lockdown America and many articles, and now of the book The Soft Cage, about surveillance in America. But we're not talking about The Soft Cage, but we will talk about that maybe in about a month or so. But I should say that Christian will be reading from the book The Soft Cage at the Park Slope Barnes & Noble in Brooklyn September 3rd. I think that's 6 days from now, Wednesday, September 3rd at 7 p.m. The Barnes & Noble in Park Slope on 7th Avenue. I think it's near 1st Street, but I'm not quite sure about that. Don't know my broken geography as well as I should, but... The Park Slope Barnes & Noble next Wednesday, September 3rd, 7 p.m. Christian Parenti will be reading from his book, The Soft Cage, about surveillance in America from slavery to the Patriot Act.
The War on Terror.
The War on Terror. Well, okay. Well, the reason Christian is here is because he just paid a visit to Iraq and was hanging around in Baghdad and wandering the streets and following some U.S. soldiers around. So thought I'd get him to report on what he saw there. Welcome to WBAI, Christian.
Thanks a lot. It's good to be here.
So you were in Iraq for a couple of weeks, right?
Yeah, 2 weeks in Baghdad.
And so, first of all, how do you get there from here?
Well, you fly to either Kuwait or Jordan. Most journalists fly to Amman, Jordan, and then you have to hire an SUV. SUVs will travel in caravans from Amman to Baghdad because the road in closer to Baghdad is still pretty dangerous. So they'll caravan in like four or five caravans and drive 95 miles an hour down this actually pretty nice highway for the most part, trying to avoid quote-unquote Alibabas, as the slang prevails on both sides of the line in Baghdad these days for thieves. And so that's how you get in, and then, you know, there's the remnants of what was a functioning economy in Baghdad, and journalists find a hotel room, and you have to hire a translator if you don't speak Arabic, which I don't, and did. And then you either take cabs or hire a car and go about your business, and there's no real telephone service except for the people who are working with the occupying forces who have satellite phones that all have Westchester County phone numbers. But everyone else in Baghdad has either very small pockets of local telephone service or no phones at all. So you travel around in a car a lot and interview people. And
Now, the line coming out of the Bush administration is that despite all these reports we see of chaos in Iraq, exploding water mains, exploding oil pipelines, exploding UN headquarters, actually things are getting much, much better. And these are deceptive, headline-grabbing, but deceptive stories. What did you see? Are things as bad as they seem?
Well, it's hard to say ultimately, but what I saw on the street was was definitely mounting chaos and a lot of violence. As I mentioned off air, happened upon a major firefight on the same day that the Jordanian embassy was bombed, and two journalists I was with and I were the first press on the scene there and watched the whole thing unfold for 2 hours. And what had happened was a U.S. Humvee pulled up on the median to park and go by, so the soldiers could go buy electronics, go buy in particular air conditioners, because a lot of these guys are now sort of hold up in old government buildings like a police station or a school or something like that, and they turn that into a base where usually there'll be like 200 or 300 soldiers, and they have to try and air condition this, and so they buy a lot of electronics. So it was a matter of time before one of these guys got blown up or capped, and this Humvee got blown up, and then these soldiers were pinned down there. And this sort of stuff happens, according to the coalition, which tends to minimize these numbers, happens 13 times a day at least. And the U.S. troops there are under constant assault, and there's a massive crime wave in Baghdad. The morgue, the previous July reported 10 murders. This past July they reported 470. Many women and girls don't go out of their homes because there are what are called misery gangs, sort of rape gangs that go around and abduct women and gang rape them and then dump them back on the street, where unfortunately sometimes their humiliated quote unquote families will kill them in honor killings, which was a practice that was made legal after the Gulf War by Saddam when he was trying to shore up his regime with resort to sort of traditionalist misogynist rhetoric and policy. And there's not enough electricity. The electricity is officially on 12 hours a day, but it's not on 12 hours a day in most neighborhoods. It'll be on for 3 hours and off for 3 hours, and then on again. But normally it's on for 3 hours and then off for sometimes up to 6 hours. And in 115, 120 degree heat, that becomes very, very difficult. If a family doesn't have a generator, it means any kind of perishable food can't be kept. It means people's nerves are on end. The air is totally polluted because of the lack of a functioning power grid. So everyone's sort of just burning diesel fuel wherever they can. These generators burning garbage. And it's incredibly chaotic and incredibly, maybe not incredibly, but it's very chaotic and very violent. And there are these U.S. soldiers there who are stretched thin, don't speak Arabic. Often I was surprised after hanging out with some of them, very poorly supplied, kind of mistreated by the military bureaucracy, and the situation seems to be disintegrating by the day.
I want to get back to the issue of the American soldiers who are there in a moment, but what could you tell about the people who are launching the attacks on the occupation forces? Are they, as Rumsfeld says, bitter enders who are just the ragtag remnants of the Saddam Hussein regime, or is there a broad-based hostility to the American and British forces among the Iraqi population?
It's very hard to say. There is a broad-based hostility against the occupying forces, and it's developing as conditions deteriorate. But that doesn't necessarily translate into armed resistance, because Iraqis have been through three wars in 20 years, and they're really sick of fighting and dying, and the vast majority of them want peace. So, again and again, people said, you guys want the oil? Take the oil. That's fine. Take all the oil. What we want is electricity and running water and basic security, and just leave us alone and we'll be fine. And just take off. Leave. But they weren't saying, you know, we're going to fight to the last man. So it's hard to say. But it seems that there are clearly elements of Saddam security forces that are operating, and then there are also Islamist forces developing, sort of jihadist guerrilla forces developing among the Sunni community primarily, and out of the Sunni mosques. And the two articles that I know of by journalists who have gotten into these cells got into Islamist sort of fundamentalist jihadist guerrilla organizations for interviews, and they were Sunni based and they were in central Baghdad. But it's also definitely known that there are former Fedayeen, which is sort of like, they were like Saddam's brown shirts. They were run by his son Uday, and they're still operating. They're getting busted, and they have arms and all that. So I think there's a mosaic of forces that are hitting U.S. and coalition targets.
You said brown shirts. So let's be clear on this. This was really a dreadful regime for which we should hold no nostalgia, right?
Yeah, it was a really, really awful regime. The translator that who was a friend of a friend who we worked with had been recruited into the Fedayeen when he was 17 because he was a ranked martial artist and an A student, and they came and recruited him, forced him into the Fedayeen. He said, "I'm my mother's only son." They said, "No, you're Iraq's son." And so he was forced into the Fedayeen, where he would witness this militia that wasn't part of the army. It was this sort of parallel domestic militia do stuff like throw 10, quote-unquote, you know, alleged homosexuals out of the helicopter. They would force these young guys in their training to jump off bridges of 100, 200 feet into the water. And 70. This one time he told us 70 of them jumped off and 3 of them didn't make it to the shore. So this guy finally shot himself in the knee to get out of the Fedayeen. So, that's just a sort of a snapshot of how things were done. And, it was a brutal...
But it was, a fascist is not not an inaccurate word to use.
Yeah, it was a fascist regime. And, in sort of old-fashioned European fascist form, it had a corporatist economic element. It had a strong state sector that was totally corrupt and all that, but it in the interest of political stability and national allegiance and obedience, it also redistributed wealth to some extent, not in any kind of extremely egalitarian fashion, but in a functional fashion. It was a sort of classic corporatist fascist economy in many ways.
I'm speaking with the journalist Christian Parenti, who has just visited Iraq and Baghdad specifically. And he is also the author of the book The Soft Cage, which is just coming out from Basic Books about surveillance in America, and we'll be talking to him about that in a month or so. But meanwhile, let's just talk about Iraq and ignore my cell phone ringing in my briefcase until it goes away. Let's. You hooked up with some American soldiers, a National Guard unit from Florida. Tell us who they were and what they were like.
Well, the whole embedding program is getting very informal. The situation there with the military is getting much more informal as it gets stretched out and stressed out. And so it's very easy. You don't have to get trained or really jump through that many bureaucratic hoops as a journalist, to hook up with a military unit and go on patrols and live with them, essentially. So after a little persistence, a friend and I, quote-unquote, embedded, hooked up with this military unit and spent some time living and patrolling with them, not a long time. And they were Florida National Guard. They'd been mobilized in December. They'd been in theater since January. They had crossed into Iraq on the very first day of the invasion in February. And they had been through the entire war, and they had seen really brutal stuff, and they had been forced to do really bad stuff. One guy that I interviewed mistakenly shot a child in Nasiriyah, and they were stuck there now in Baghdad. They were held up in an old Republican Guard army base that was an officers' club, which was now their base, and they would patrol every day for 4 hours a day on foot in intervals of 1 or 2 hours. And sometimes at night in Humvees, patrol this working-class neighborhood in Baghdad, where there was some people were friendly and many people were openly hostile to them. And they would receive occasional fire, not that often, but occasionally their patrols would be fired on. Occasionally the base had received a couple RPG, one RPG attack where a couple rocket-propelled grenades were shot at them. So they're stressed out. They're there. But the key thing is that they're National Guardsmen, so they're... A lot of them were guys who had done 4 years in the military and then signed up for 6 years in the National Guard so that they could get college tuition paid in Florida. So they're sort of like upwardly mobile, ambitious, working, and lower middle class guys. And they're figured that this last stint with the army would entail directing traffic during hurricanes or, you know, some weekends playing war in the woods, and they get a call and they go to Iraq, and they don't yet have a date when they're going to leave. They don't know whether they're going to be there for another 6 months or another 2 months or possibly worse, another year. And they're incredibly angry. And
who are they angry at?
They're angry primarily at the military, and they're also angry at Iraqis. And they're, you know, I mean, to put it bluntly, their politics are pretty racist. You know, they're angry at quote unquote Hajis, which is the military slang for Iraqis. And their consciousness is essentially, I mean, it's something akin, it's the military equivalent to what Lenin talked about, you know, guild consciousness, how workers who don't have sort of an abstract political theory to explain their situation will just develop a kind of workerist guild consciousness that focuses on their immediate conditions and the immediate situation with supervisors. And that's the level of the critique of these soldiers. They think the army is dysfunctional. They know they're being abused by inept officers. They don't get proper supplies. They don't get enough proper bottled water. So most of what they have to drink is this highly polluted chlorinated water. The military is telling them they can't write messages on their helmets. They can't wear headbands. They have to roll down their sleeves, and at the same time they have to go out and kill people if necessary. And they experience the contradictions of this, and they think they are ridiculous and outrageous, and they are absolutely infuriated. And the easiest targets are Iraqis, though they are, you know, they do restrain themselves, and the officers are, you know, try and keep the troops in line who are too aggressive. But there, I mean, I cannot report that there is some sort of incipient mutiny on the way among the unit that I hung out with in Iraq. But there is a kind of pre-political, very explicit, very vocal resentment about the situation and about how they, as military workers, are being screwed over and lied to and abused.
It's been too great if we can try to organize them somehow. But that would be a big task. Did you?
The thing is, you know, it's akin to organizing prisoners. I've done a bit of research in prison, and it felt very similar to prison. And these guys are locked down. When they're not out pushing people around and shooting at people outside the base, they are prisoners. You know, they're not free to leave. They don't get much media, and so they're a very hard. They would be a very hard population to organize, but.
But also, it's 120 degree heat, and they've got crappy water.
Yeah. And their families are organizing. And the thing is, if some of these guys who've been there almost a year don't come home soon, I think there is going to develop stateside some very serious problems politically among the families.
And were they free to communicate their distress to their families?
I think they are. My impression is that their email is not read, because there's actually no military provision for email for most of these guys. So what the base that I was at, the captain essentially, it was a company, so it's like 200, 250 guys, several platoons. The captain invited in a local Iraqi entrepreneur who had the money to set up a deal with MCI, which currently controls all the mobile satellite phones in Baghdad, and had the money to buy a couple computers. And so this guy, who had an internet cafe in the neighborhood, because Iraq was a highly developed economy, I mean a third world economy, but that had oil, that had achieved a significant level of development. So there are people like this around with cash and know-how to set up internet cafes. So the captain invited this guy in to set up a little internet cafe on the base, because the military wasn't providing any method for any means for the soldiers to communicate with home. Likewise, the guys all pooled together and bought a Soraya satellite phone, and they buy these cards which cost, you know, $1.50 a minute to call home. And so they privately pooled together and bought a satellite phone, and they have a list, and so they're constantly sharing this phone to call home, touch base with their wives and family, mothers and fathers. There's a lot of weird improvisation in this kind of urban front lines. They hate the food they eat, so they finally convinced their captain to allow a kebab stand in the neighborhood to come inside the base so that they could spend some of their money avoiding those meals ready to eat and eating grilled lamb instead. So
And finally, one of the things you wanted to study when you went over there was what was up with the Iraqi Communist Party. What did you find?
Yeah, unfortunately, the Iraqi Communist Party was traditionally the second largest party and was always in competition with the Ba'athist Party. And they suffered massive repression under Saddam and mostly went into exile. They operated in Kurdistan under the protection of some pretty reactionary Kurdish parties. But there was always there's always been a link between the Iraqi Communist Party and Kurds, because there were a lot of Kurds were in the Communist Party, a lot of Jews and Kurds in the Communist Party, and then that helped facilitate the link with the Kurdish parties. But the Iraqi Communist Party is at this point sort of a social democratic party. It's cooperating or collaborating, however one wants to view it, with the occupation. There's a smaller party that's pretty vocal, the Iraqi Communist Workers Party, and they've organized a women's group, and they've organized the Union of the Unemployed, and they hold pretty militant demonstrations, but they're usually of only a few hundred people, sometimes up to 800 people, demanding jobs and benefits for the unemployed. And their headquarters, the Communist Workers Party, is, for example, they're in a looted bank that they have to guard with M16s against the activists of one of the Sunni mosques that's trying to drive them out of that building and all of their buildings. So I wish I could report that there's an upsurge of secular left organizing, and there is some very, very valiant effort, particularly around the question of women's rights and workers' rights, but it's very small, and they're up against tremendous odds, and they're doing it in the middle of a gathering urban guerrilla war and possibly a civil war.
All right, we'll have to end it there. Thank you for joining us, Christian Parenti, who is a journalist who's just been in Iraq, and Christian's most recent book, The Soft Cage, is just being published by Basic Books, and he'll be reading from it next Wednesday, September 3rd, at the Park Slope Barnes & Noble.
And there's an article, I've written up some of this stuff that's coming out in These Times and also in The Nation in the next 2 weeks.
Okay. All right. Thanks for joining us, Christian. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on to the evening. And let's go out with a little bit more Roxy music. Just me too, just to search for something new.